Did you see the stylish kids in the riot? Shoveled up like monks at the night on fire, wombles bleed, truncheons and shields. You know I cherish you, my love.
Welcome to the Young IPA Podcast. I'm James, this is Pete.
G'day everyone.
It is the 18th of May and this is episode 60 and we've got a huge, huge show for you guys coming up. We're going to be talking to Professor Mark Bauerlein from Emory University.
Awesome chat.
Awesome, awesome chat. So he wrote an article you might have seen in Hey, What Did I Miss recently about the disappearance of great books from the universities in America.
Yeah.
And so we had a great chat with him about why that is, what can be done about it. And honestly, you are going to walk away with a reading list a mile long from all the books he recommends. It's a really interesting chat. Hope you guys enjoy it. We're also going to be talking to, I've forgotten, Gideon Rosner. Gideon Rosner, research fellow here at the IPA, with a really fun chat about his time in the US, how he got to talk at a tax cut rally in Iowa, which is a really fun story.
On the megaphone.
Absolutely. And what he made of the government's ban on $10,000 cash payments. So that's also a really fun chat. Joined, as always, by the greatest butter... I'm completely tongue-tied right now. Greatest presser of buttons this country's ever seen, Nina Lohan Arthur.
Hi.
Did the stuttering diminish in any way the niceness of that compliment?
That's okay.
I think it showed that you were nervous and then you knew it was a moment of gravity.
I know. Yeah. You were excited. I just want to get the words wrong. I forgive you.
Okay, good. All right. Well, let's get into this week's story. So, obviously, the whole country can't stop talking about the upcoming royal wedding. Of I think it's Saturday or it might be Tuesday. I forget which.
Saturday, what a combo.
Yeah, well, it's a big wedding.
Saturday or Tuesday.
Yeah, so obviously there's a lot of opinions out there. There's a lot of stories leaking on Meghan Markle's side. I thought we'd take some time at the start of the show for me and Pete to get all of our royal wedding takes out of the way early just to clutter up, free the clutter for the rest of the show.
Hello, this is
good. Okay, we can stop it there. So, yeah, well, I mean, obviously some people are very happy. I think friend of the podcast, Morgan Begg, is going to be watching.
Georgina Downer,
but not a fan of Megan. So you can go back and listen to that show if you want to hear what her take is. Let's talk some stories.
Well, do you care, Nina, about this? I actually do have some takes.
Oh, really? Go ahead. Why didn't you bring it up?
I just had them then. I didn't realize that she was American.
Really?
Yeah.
What?
It's been in a magazine and all that. Really?
I just assumed
where
she
have
was
you
like,
been?
That she was like, you know, British aristocracy.
No.
Right.
And the other thing was...
Pete, did you ever read a paper that's not the Melbourne FC?
I did today. No, actually, someone told me that. I didn't read that.
Right.
But Emma Thompson also, did you see her today, cracked it when someone asked her about the royal wedding. She was like, you know, I don't know these people. Why should I have to... I love Emma Thompson.
Yep. Okay. Okay. Great actress.
She's probably a horrendous lefty, but I wouldn't mind being mates with her.
Lefties make good mates.
Do you care about the royal wedding, Nina?
I care just because it's hyped at all.
Like, just, you're just a hype merchant.
It's like, I don't really know them anyway, so I don't get invited. So I was like, meh.
Okay.
Yeah, once Nina was off the guest list, she's out.
Yeah.
No, we don't care.
Nina and Meghan Markle's dad both. So let's talk some stories that I actually care about. So... last week we were talking about how the ABC freaked out over the cuts that were like the quote unquote cuts or like frozen
cut to
bonuses.
The bone.
Yeah. Well, anyway, they were up in arms in riot about it. So, obviously they were saying there's nothing in the ABC that can be cut and any cut amounts to a war on the ABC. The Australians found something that probably could be cut. This story coming out on Wednesday, the ABC paid out more than $2.6 million in bonuses, including nine of more than 50,000 to its highest paid staff last year. I can find somewhere to be cut, Pete.
I think
we found something.
No, what's that for? Is that for bringing in heaps of advertising revenue?
Yeah. Oh.
Most bonuses are attached to profit.
Yeah, exactly. So two bonuses were given $69,725 on top of their average $350,000 salaries, according to the ABC's remuneration disclosure information.
Is that Tony? That's not Tony.
Tony would be on more than $350,000, I feel.
Ooh.
I mean, he's a big light, isn't he?
I don't know.
If it's not, yeah, it's only royal weddings in Melbourne FC that Pete cares about. If Tony was at the royal wedding, Pete would immediately know his salary.
Yeah, sure.
That's my take. Pete, shall we talk Spotify?
Yes, we should talk
Unless
Spotify.
Unless you had any more takes on the ABC.
I was going to ask if that lady you asked that said babies should up, you asked their consent before they had their nappies changed if she got a bonus.
Well, again, it's
because she got cut through.
she got cut through.
She got people talking.
She got people talking about the ABC. She got people in the media. So, yeah, I'd assume she would be on above 350 salary. So the two biggest salary bonuses there were for people on 350,000. So I don't think we're quite at her level yet.
All right. Fair enough then. So, yes, onto Spotify, as you rightly pointed out, James. Spotify have announced that they're going to remove from their playlists. So that doesn't mean remove completely, but remove from their playlists music that contains, what is it, hateful content. So that is the normal sort of collection of stuff that we're all pretty familiar with. In addition, though, and this is quite interesting, they're going to remove artists who have engaged in hateful conduct in their real lives. So that includes a much larger section of...
I would say almost all-encompassing. Pretty much
every rock star that's ever lived. So when I say remove from their playlist, I don't mean they're going to remove the music completely from...
Yeah, but they'll take away from like mass playlists, which is going to hurt new fans to their music. So it's going to be harder for them to like reach out to new audiences.
Which I did find amusing because it's Spotify sort of saying, look, we care about violence against women and we care about all this stuff, but we're not going to complete... We need some of that revenue.
Yeah, absolutely. We
have to make a little bit of money out of that sort of kind of content. So we're going to leave them on the platform.
We don't want to alienate their current fans. We just want them to stop reaching people who are going to get angry about this.
That's correct. And as sort of we all forecast, now that activists are calling for a whole range of artists to be removed on the basis of their conduct, so the Eagles, who else have we got here, James?
Eminem,
Red Hot Chili Peppers, massive bands. So one band they did miss, which was interesting to me, was the Beatles.
Two of the 50%
of the Beatles
yeah.
have like admitted publicly that they assaulted their partners.
Mm-hmm.
So I love how this feminist group cares about violence against women, but not the Beatles.
Yeah, we'll go after them later.
there's violence against women.
I wonder if that has anything to do with over a billion streams for Beatles songs on Spotify.
Well,
the reason they're not going after them.
Well, yeah.
But yeah, like as Pete points out, sorry, Spotify announced they were doing this, and this is like the bat signal to to like lefty groups that kind of want to do all activists. That. Like the second the signal goes up, like every activist gets off their couch. They're like, okay, what are my bugbear issues? What are the bands I have problems with? Let's get some headlines, people.
Yeah, exactly. And it's just good when, like, I mean, obviously, but we should always stress that, you know, private organisations, they can do whatever they want.
And Spotify's Kelly is a jerk.
R. Kelly is. And some, like, a lot of these people are reprehensible that they're talking about. And, you know, I have no problem with that. But it's just funny when one of these corporations, they all sit around going, oh, let's wade into this social justice issue. This will be a home run with the punters. And then 10 seconds into that, they realise this is more complicated than we anticipated.
Yep. And we're only going to support this until the profit falls into loss.
Yeah, we all need.
We're abandoning this forever.
Yep. So interesting to see how that unfolds. I think they'll just dog it eventually.
Absolutely. So someone that we hope won't dog it.
Yeah.
So moving on. So Pete and I have always had this sort of idea that we have the podcast bump.
Particularly you.
Yeah. Well, I like talking about myself. So this podcast, obviously, like, you know, we have a lot of really fun guests on. And sometimes good things happen to them after they come on the show. So Andrew Bogut signs a lucrative 2-year deal with the Sydney Kings. We've had a bunch of...
He went from the NBA to the NBL, mate.
Well, you know, look, 2-year deals are better than 1-year deals.
Okay, yeah, I'll give you
that. So financial security is nothing to be sniffed
When's
at.
When's this bump going to hit the host? That's my question.
Well, eventually.
Anyway, carry on. Cool. I interrupted.
No, it's all good. But we want to say that friend of the podcast, friend of the IPA, one of our research fellows, Georgina Downer, running for the seat of mayor. We wish her nothing but the best. So, yeah, that's all I wanted to say.
Surely you should, you should be running for the seat of mayor.
Yeah, well, because I'm the king of mayor. I'm surprised it's a democracy. I thought it was an autocracy.
Nina loved that one. Look at her.
Yes, I do spread mayonnaise on my stories to make them better.
All right.
Cool. So, yeah, best of luck to Georgina.
Cool.
Cool. So, that's all we got for stories at the start. We'll now go to our interviews with Mark and Gideon. Before we do, we are available on this podcast. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you so much for subscribing. We are available on iTunes, SoundCloud, our website. You can listen through our Hey What Did I Miss email. Make sure you guys are subscribed. Make sure you guys are telling people that you know that would like the podcast about it. Help get the word out there. Nina, if people like what the IPA does around the podcast, what can they do to become even more involved?
Well, just be a member. Visit our website, ipa.org.au, and click on that join button. And starting as low as $22 per year, you'll get invitations for our exclusive events and also free editions of IPA Review on our magazines.
Very cool. All right. There's one part of my notes that I didn't get to. So event plugging. So yep. We've got an event next on the 21st of May. If you're in Brisbane, come along to the Great Debate, Capitalism v Socialism. We've got two speakers, obviously one on the side of capitalism, one on the side of socialism. We had an event in Perth last night, I want to say, same topic. Capitalism won. You'll be happy to know there was a 6% swing in the room towards capitalism.
Is that right?
Yeah. So, yeah, really cool event. Hope you guys enjoyed it in Perth. Let us know what you thought of it. And if you are in Brisbane, make sure you come along. Okay, we are now joined for the first time by Mark Bauerlein, the English professor at Emory University. So, Mark is the author of a really cool article on the great books and the sort of threat that they're under in American universities. I'll do a bit of an introduction just in case our listeners haven't heard of you. So, professor at Emory University. In 2008, you published The Dumbest Generation, How the Digital Age Stupefies Young Americans and Jeopardizes Our Future, or Don't Trust Anyone Under 30. So you're a strong advocate for teaching of the great books in Western universities. So in this article that you wrote for Mining the Campus called The Overthrow of the Great Books, you sort of talk about how famous works of English literature are under siege in American universities. So what are these books and why do you think they've been overthrown or under siege?
Well, there's the ideological or multicultural problem in that great books traditionally have been aligned with Western civilization, which means they're authored by a lot of dead white males. And haven't we had enough of them? Isn't it time to look at other things? So they are partly an expression of a tradition that simply needed to be displaced in the eyes of a lot of people. And that project had a fair degree of resentment, ressentiment, as Nietzsche put it, where you got people coming along who simply didn't like the idea of calling these things great. I proposed a program for great books once, and a colleague once said, when you imply that certain books are great, then you're implying that other books that we teach aren't great. Well, I just let that on the table stay because it was such a patent truth that some books are great and most books aren't great. The problem is they see that you end up saying that the people who teach those not so great books aren't as good as the people who teach the great books. And I wouldn't go that far, but I would say that there are distinctions in the activities going on there. So that's one thing, the multiculturalist resentment against this tradition that seems too narrow and identified with one demographic group. The other thing is they're hard. They take a lot of time and effort. Paradise Lost is not an easy read. I think it's absolutely fantastic. I love delving into it, but it takes time and effort. And the sad thing is that a lot of my colleagues who've gotten PhDs in English or in other languages and literatures, they haven't done their homework. They've taken the easy way out. They haven't become erudite, well-read individuals. Maybe they've done too much contemporary literature. Maybe they've read a little theory that allows them to spin out interpretations in a facile way. But they don't have the depth. I mean, I have been in meetings with people working up standards, education standards for high school English. And when I mentioned that we've got to retain the great age of English satire, John Dryden, Alexander Pope, Jonathan Swift, I said, we've got to teach Dryden's Absalom and Achitophel. I get because they haven't read those books. They haven't read those poems. That's just another reason why people really get nervous about this tradition. It takes a lot of homework.
Mark, you've gone through a very interesting transition yourself. You used to be a Democrat, now you're a Republican. You used to be an atheist, now you're a Catholic. Has this transition sort of fed into your fight for the great books? Has it been a thing that's happened concurrently?
It really works in the other direction. I used to be a secular, atheist, liberal kind of guy. I would never vote for a Republican because I thought they were all either stupid or greedy. But I was always an education conservative. And In fact, when you go back to the mid-20th century in America and England, the left-wingers were devoted to this tradition in education because they said that denying the working classes the study of Shakespeare and Homer is a way of keeping them down. Why should the upper crust get Hamlet and the children of minors not get Hamlet? So studying the great books in the old days used to be actually a progressive project. It was a way of giving the working classes the chance for class mobility, for climbing the income ladder. Well, that changed over the course of the 20th century, and that the great books and the classics became, again, a kind of elite conservative project. Well, I was always committed to that simply by virtue of the fact that when I was 17 and 18 years old and was becoming a rabid atheist, I ate Nietzsche up. I read Freud, especially Freud on the psychology of faith and religion. I read Nietzsche on the fact that Jesus Christ was the greatest nihilist who ever lived. That was Nietzsche's interpretation of Jesus as a nihilist in the sense that Jesus destroyed all worldly hierarchies. He put children first. He equated kings and beggars. For Nietzsche, this made him the great leveler of everything. Well, I loved this stuff. This is where I went when I lost my faith in God. Boy, was I taken by a lot of these great thinkers. And I almost made a religion out of this tradition. And this wasn't unusual. I mean, there were a lot of people in Victorian England who made a kind of religion out of literature as a replacement for Orthodox Christianity. So when I saw my left turn against the great books, that actually inspired me to think more broadly about my conservatism. And then I had a child and realized so many liberal aspects of culture were actually quite awful for children.
Absolutely. So to go back to the great books for a second, you brought up before how a lot of the opposition to the great books is driven by ressentiment, which was a really interesting part of the article. I also want to see if you sort of see the influence of identity politics in American universities as being underpinning a lot of the opposition. Do you see that as the identity politics really infecting the sort of teaching of English?
Identity politics is tearing America apart. And I'm sure you see this better on the outside than a lot of us do here on the inside. Identity politics has given us tribalism. We have lost our common Americanness. We don't feel in this country anymore, we don't feel whatever other differences we have, we're all Americans. We don't believe anymore in that. No one feels the commonality that we're all together on some level. Of course, we have differences, we have different interests, and there are factions, and some of them can be charted by demographic identity, but we're all Americans deep down, and there's a brotherhood in our citizenship. Well, that's pretty much gone. And the tribalism is only getting worse. And the humanities is one of the places, in the human university, is one of the places where identity politics hit very hard early on. And so I gave a speech at Wesleyan University a while back, and I quoted Emerson, Walt Whitman, and Henry David Thoreau. And the first question from the students was, I noticed you quoted three white men. Do you think that's right? I just said, I can't believe that I am hearing this kind of thing in 2017. People said this in 1987, and it was already getting old at that time, but it has stuck, and it's so anti-intellectual, it's so obtuse. My response was, you know, Emerson said, whoso would be a man must be a nonconformist. How can a woman read this, right? Well, the fact is that a lot of very strong-minded, powerful, willful intelligent women in 1845 read Emerson and said to themselves, that's me. That's me. Now, were they wrong to do that? Well, of course, the audience didn't have an answer to that because they were suffering from resentment. And you can't, that's an irrational condition. You can't argue that away. And when I see this kind of irrationality settle in to the humanities, I realize these are people who haven't read enough. They haven't acquired a literary sensibility that will help them take a somewhat ironic, occasionally distant perspective on themselves and the ideas that they have. That's one of the things that a literary education does. And the great books are the best instrument for that, because if you get rid of the idea of greatness, then you can't think deeply about anything.
So you've just touched on it a little bit briefly there, but if we could go in a bit more detail about what this absence of the great books means for the future of intellectual inquiry in America and in the West. If students aren't learning this stuff, what does that mean for the future?
Well, the first thing I would say is the human element. What a loss. What a loss for a 19-year-old not to encounter works of momentous power and depth and profundity and brilliance and comedy and tragedy. I mean, these kids are going through things like romances and they get their hearts broken. Well, let me tell you, there is no greater examination of rejection than in the Aeneid when Aeneas leaves Dido. And Dido is devastated, and she goes through all of the emotions, yelling at Aeneas, telling him, you've destroyed me. He sneaks off in the night. He knows better. I got to get out of here real fast and on the sly. And what does she do? She builds a big pile of furniture on which she and Aeneas have been making love. And they're both admirable characters. We're caught up in their love affair. They're extraordinary, heroic individuals. She builds this pyre. She climbs to the top. She has them light it on fire. And she takes his sword and she stabs herself with it. Now, this rumination, he encounters her again when he goes down into the underworld. And he doesn't know she's dead. And it's a very powerful moment of realization. These are the materials through which young people should be processing experiences. It helps give them the emotional and intellectual equipment to understand themselves and the world they live in and what's happening to them. Do we want to, what do we want to give them instead? Pop culture versions of how to deal with these kinds of things? What a denial we are doing to the young when we do this. The second thing is just the power of tradition. The historical value of these materials and the inheritance that they add up to, it belongs to us. And every individual should be able to take possession of this inheritance as the things that have helped produce the humanity that you are trying to grow into.
So that was really awesome. But if we can't rely on universities to be teaching these books to children, do you think the children will start to discover these books themselves? At the end of your article, you had a really optimistic note about, I mean, how these books continue to resonate with readers and students. Do you see the same books being read 100 years from now, or do you think universities are destroying them?
They will be read 100 years ago because they're too good to go away. And there will always be a small group. I mean, in the Middle Ages, it was the Benedictine monks who kept these great works alive. There will always be a small group, at least, who keeps them alive. You're also going to find in the next few years, because we're seeing this a little bit already, great books programs springing up in universities that are outside the normal English department, comparative literature departments, outside, they're these centers or these special programs run in a different way. And the students are going to gravitate there because when students major in English or the humanities in general or art history or music history, they don't do it because it's going to teach them critical thinking. Who cares? They do it because they had a high school teacher who made Jane Austen come alive. They read Great Expectations in 11th grade, and they said, I want more of this. This stuff is great. This stuff hits me hard. It's meaningful to me. If you want to reach the students, give them works that are going to stay with them for their lives. Make them listen to the first 5 minutes of Tristan, of Wagner's Tristan and Isolde. Make them look at paintings like The Raft of the Medusa and think about them. These are going to stick with them when they're 18 years old. And they are leaving the humanities in higher education today. They're leaving the humanities. The number of kids taking humanities courses and majoring in the humanities is going down. And one reason is identity politics. Because identity politics are a downer. Wait, you're going to sit and talk about Emerson and how racist he is? Well, I don't want to take this class. I mean, I don't want to hear so much negativity, which is what you get in so many of these courses. And identity politics is a negative. It's not a positive for formation. So they're leaving that, but they will go to places where they can get inspiration. They will go to a place where teachers are going to make the materials meaningful to them, and they're going to feel like I am in conversation with historic geniuses, and that's what I want. I am 19. I've left high school. I'm on my own, heading out into the world, and I want guides who have stature. I don't want to take courses in Harry Potter, which is what, you know, what a lot of English teachers think are going to bring students back. No, I want to take courses on Satan spying on Eve in Paradise Lost. It's extraordinary what happens in that episode. I want to think about the St. Augustine going with all those boys one night and destroying the pear orchard and then spending 5 pages wondering, why didn't I do that? That is the greatest rumination on peer pressure among adolescents ever written. It is so modern and, to use their word, relevant. This is going to keep the humanities. This is going to keep great books, the classics, going, because the material's too good to be lost. And the sad thing is too many students are not going to realize they can get it in higher education.
Mark, carry on.
We need to have more humanities teachers telling students, in my class, you're going to get something so much better than pop culture, youth culture, rap music, website, you know, Facebook nonsense. You're going to get something that is fantastic here, and it's going to change who you are.
Terrific. Mark, you've probably inspired a lot of our listeners to read a lot more of the great books. A few of them probably missed out on the education that you're talking about. Where is a good place to start? Or where's, you know, give us like 3 books that they should read to start off with. I know that's a difficult question, but...
You know, there are a lot of really good lectures. First of all, just introductory materials, lectures on YouTube. You've got great books programs that you can get through the web. You can order CDs that have lectures on them, great books, kinds of things, the great courses program. People can look those up. Now, what I would say is for people who are interested in, say, different issues like religion, politics, there are the familiar names. I mean, if you're young, Nietzsche, Dostoevsky, these guys are going to grab you. I'll tell you, maybe I should get to your question. I think the books that grabbed me, The Brothers Karamazov. When I was 18, I read it. It was in a freshman class in college at UCLA, and Ivan Karamazov hit me very hard. Ivan is the brother who's lost his faith. He no longer believes in God, but he's not a happy atheist. He's a miserable figure who understands his own plight, his own condition of being without God is a horror to him, but he has too much intellectual honesty to delude himself, in his terms, into believing in God. He was someone I identified with. And you want to look for the books that you can make an identification in some way. So that was one book that hit me very hard. Jean-Paul Sartre's novel La Nausea. That is a portrait of nihilism, of a nihilist trying to come to terms with a meaningless world, a world that is entirely factitious, in which every experience he has is just gratuitous. It's just there. There's no deeper meaning to anything. And how he sort of tries to cope with that, that was a powerful book for me. People of faith who are looking for inspirational stories of faith, they would look elsewhere, obviously. I would say to young people, what is your emotional and psychological condition? And what are the great books that can answer to that? And you know what? Your listeners, they can email me. I get emails. You know, I wrote this book, Insulting 93 Million Americans, The Dumbest Generation. I get emails from young people a lot. And many of them say, what should I do? What should I read? And I write back and say, tell me what your interests are, and then I'll give you recommendations. And your listeners can certainly contact me. I'm always available. I respond to every email I've gotten, even the ones with four-letter words in them. And we try and have a good fruitful exchange. And my email, you can just look me up, Mark Bauerlein, Emory University, and my contact information will come up, and people should feel free to ask me questions.
Brilliant. Mark Bauerlein, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Okay, we're now joined once again by a great friend of the podcast and occasional ring-in when we need to fill in host.
One-time co-host.
And we'll probably be again co-host when we finally do away with Peter. Gideon Rosner, welcome back.
Thank you. Great to be here, guys.
Now, and welcome back to the country. Now, last week we did speak to Dan about the LA trip. We've sent you and Dan over there to learn how to make videos better and also connect with fellow free market think tanks from all over the world at the Lights, Camera, Liberty Foundation. Event organized by the Atlas Foundation, or Atlas Network, I think it is. Gideon, you want to talk about your experiences there?
Well, look, I know you talked to Dan about what the seminar involved, so I won't go too much into the details, but I think it achieved two things going. Firstly, it gave me a completely different mindset on how we approach getting our message out. And we have to be better storytellers. We cannot rely on dry economics or facts. To give an example, my area here is largely dignity of work, which is an IR, industrial relations related practice.
Ironic, really.
Sorry?
Ironic name.
Oh, sometimes I'm dignified and sometimes I work, so.
Just one day the two will intersect. Yeah. You'll be dignified at work.
Well, I pray for the day, I really do. But until then, I'm talking about dignity of work for others. And, you know, the debate about industrial relations in this country is usually Labor saying, how can you talk about the minimum wage in that way. How can you lower wages? How can you take food out of the mouths of kids? And we'll respond by saying, well, you see, the importance of a flexible wage rate is that it allows businesses to be more flexible and then profit and gradually benefit the economy.
And not, most people's eyes have glazed over.
Correct. They're like, well, great guy in a suit and a blue tie. Go back to your, you know, wherever you came from. What we need to be saying is, how dare you unions keep wages artificially high and keep people poor and on the dole and out of work because your rent-seeking behaviour makes sure that wages are such that a lot of good people are kept out of work? How dare you deprive people of the dignity of work? Then, of course, the other thing to come out of Lights, Camera, Liberty was that it was a great primer on the technical aspects of making films and making movies, and we're not going to be releasing any Hollywood pictures anytime soon, as far as I'm aware, but we
are. That attitude.
Well, you know, one day we'll have IPA the movie at Hoyts and Village Cinemas, but until then.
I'm played by Matt Damon. Well, to my dying breath, I will say I kind of look like Matt Damon. No one has ever believed me. No one has ever agreed with me.
I can see that, but I hope you're not like the Matt Damon from Team America.
No. I'm much more articulate and better at Kung Fu.
On a good day.
Yeah.
But it's really that. But we are expanding our YouTube content, so it's the way of thinking about making movies: how to do a budget, how to do a production plan, how to do a script, how to do a logline, how to get things out there and proliferate them, or how to make something go viral. So it was both the mindset and the technical aspects that made it a really, really, really worthwhile thing. I know you went yourself, James, and can back me up on that. So huge conference and a lot of fun.
We'll move on, but I do want to say one thing. You said there that you needed tips on how to write a script. You do not. So for people at home, I sort of review scripts for videos they're about to make just to give notes and stuff like that. And most staff members around here, because they don't have any background, will just send me sort of like their executive summary of their report, which is, you know, all I expect. Gideon sends me full screenplays formatted to industry standard
with the same
with
font.
Like, you know, the camera cuts to this, and it's impressive to watch. So I'd keep it up. You've got talent.
Yeah, well, the first time I did that, it was really for my own amusement more than anything else, but it sort of took off. But
it was like, all I need to do is like twist three words and we're done. We're already green lit.
Yeah, well, you know, there's always room for improvement, and you'll be getting big, thick Hollywood-style screenplays soon to leaf through. So 60-odd pages.
So, man of many talents, Gideon, you're also a massive hit in Iowa on your American tour. What do you tell us about that?
Yeah, so this came about because I was going to Los Angeles anyway. Stuart Eaton from the IPA said, since you're there, there's this group that is relevant to your area of policy interest that you should really meet with, called the Job Creators Network. Now, they are a grassroots advocacy group that basically campaigns for lower tax on small business and lower red tape on small business. They were very, very instrumental in getting the in lobbying for the Trump tax cuts to company tax. And as a result of that, they're now engaging in a second campaign, partly to shore up support for good, solid, and they all are Republican congressmen who voted in favour of the Trump tax cut. So they got this roadshow going all around America. Now, because of the dates, the only way it would work out for me to meet with these people is to meet them at one of their campaign stops in a place called Cedar Falls, Iowa, which, you know, if you don't know, Iowa is a smallish state. The most people in political circles know it as a place where presidential campaigns are launched. But other than that, it's not really a place you go as a tourist. Nobody thinks I'm going to go and check out New York. I'll go to Florida, Hollywood, and then maybe Iowa on the way home.
Yeah.
But
like,
it was,
when they talk about flyover states, like Iowa's
dismissively,
leading.
I might add. And, you know, there's nothing wrong with these places, but there's not a reason you go there as a tourist. So I was really excited, firstly, to actually go to middle America, to the real America. I literally stayed on a hotel on a main street in this tiny little town. And really soaked in the culture there and saw a bit of what's happening in these places. Waterloo and Cedar Rapids, Cedar Falls, they're both two related towns. They're lucky because they have a major manufacturer called John Deere, which is one of the world's largest tractor manufacturers. It's been there for 100 years. But I thought to myself, you know, and it's a functioning town with you know, restaurants and bars and coffee shops and shops and people on the street and everything else. But I thought to myself, walking around, if John Deere was crippled by red tape or overtaxation and left town, this is the kind of place that would descend into the kind of ruined landscapes you read about in things like Hillbilly Elegy.
I was just thinking that,
and
yeah.
That is why cutting company tax and red tape is so important, because business is fragile. And towns like Waterloo and Cedar Falls are always one piece of red tape away from being ruined, and it's for the sake of them that we need to make it as easy as possible to do business, you know, in Australia, of course, but in the US, as I saw, and to make sure people can excess the dignity of work. So anyway, I went to the right. So I spent a day in Waterloo, Iowa, in Cedar Falls, checking it out. And then I went to this campaign stop. It was at this manufacturer called Gerald Salke, which is the world's only remaining manufacturer of horse-drawn buggies, high-end horse-drawn buggies.
High-end?
Yeah, high-end.
Not
so
your
padded
regular
and
thing. For, right. for things this like, isn't for getting to A to B. This is for the weekend spin-outs.
No, but in fact, they export to Australia, among other places. In fact, I suspect the horse-drawn carriages you see in the Melbourne CBD are actually manufactured by this outfit. I don't know that
is
for
that
sure,
right?
But I suspect so. I don't quote me on that. I don't know that for sure, but...
breaking news, Gideon Rosner quoted as saying...
as saying, but, well, being the world's only manufacturer, it's a matter of logic. But, I mean, so they have a bus, this campaign that goes from town to town with a big sign on the back saying, honk if you love tax cuts. It's really all the pageantry and glitz and glamour of an American campaign. But aside from the, you know, the production values of it, what the organisers did was have local businessmen... They had a congressman there, a very solid congressman named Rodney Bloom, who's a Republican and a Tea Partier and holding down, in effect, a marginal seat of 3.5%. So he needs the support and the help. But they also had a couple of people who've benefited from these tax cuts. They had the person from Gerald Salke who explained that he and his wife had bought that business after leaving a very successful horse farm in a neighbouring state. They had mortgaged their home. They had taken out loans. They had put everything into this business to make it profitable. And as a result of the Trump tax cuts, this business will be profitable for the first time in years. They had another bloke there who teamed up with his brother to buy a pub on Main Street in Cedar Falls. The brother accessed finance via a special veterans finance loan product. And as a result of the Trump tax cuts, his business will survive and continue to employ people and continue to support the town. I actually feel bad because this is the same. I arrived in Waterloo very late. In Cedar Falls, rather. I get them confused. I arrived in town very late and there was nowhere to get a bite to eat. There was one place in town I heard that that was still serving food at that hour. So I called them and said, would you mind keeping the kitchen open? And they did anyway, for whatever reason. I never turned up. So I apologised to the poor boy, but he was fine.
Well,
but a very good
avid
guy.
Listener, so I think he'll get back to on this one. But yeah, like that's exactly the kind of story we'd be having in Australia if we could just actually have corporate tax cuts.
Well, firstly, you know, our tax cuts are nowhere near the ambition and the scale of the Trump tax cuts. Yeah. But secondly, you look at here, you don't hear real stories like I did in the US. Typically, a Malcolm Turnbull or a Bill Shorten or whoever else will, during a sitting week, drive out to Queanbeyan, which is just outside Canberra, find a local small business there, and they'll rant at the camera with some small businessmen nodding behind them. We really need to hear more from the people that these policies affect and start telling human stories, because again, if we just keep hitting people with dry economics and a strong economic plan for jobs and growth, we will never win hearts and minds on the things that we care about, which is freedom and prosperity.
Absolutely. So if you guys want to watch Gideon's speech, it is available on our Facebook page, and I think the whole event we linked to in the YouTube. There's also a bunch of cool photos from the day. I also the write-up of the event in the Waterloo Cheddar Falls Courier, which Gideon Rosner is quoted in. I was going to ask, is this the most obscure publication that has ever quoted you? And do you think you'll ever top it?
It means that I've broken the barrier and I'm now published internationally, which I'm very excited about.
Very cool.
I'm published overseas. And I should actually mention, because you said my speech, I turned up in a sort of sports jacket and t-shirt and pair of jeans, and I didn't realise they wanted me to speak. They had an Australian flag there and everything
really?
Else. So I got up,
cool.
So I got up, and this, you can see it online, I sort of said, apologies for not dressing up. If I knew I'd be asked to speak, I would have turned up, you know, in a suit and tie, not looking like a out-of-work jazz pianist. So now people who see this online are saying, hey, how are you, old hip cat, you jazz pianist and everything else. So
it must have been hard for you to think of something to come up with just on the spot like that.
Not really, because, you know, this is what... They're talking about the same things we're talking about. Yeah. They're talking about prosperity and freedom and opportunity. What I said was we look to the US for economic leadership. And if there's anything we need in Australia right now, it is economic leadership.
Absolutely. So you were just saying before, Pete, that mm-hmm. you'd also been quoted in a Cambodian paper now banned.
Yes.
I want to hear that story.
I wrote a piece for the Cambodia Daily, which is now banned by the Cambodian government.
Is there a link?
Yeah, yeah. It's on the IPA website.
No, no, I'm saying, is there a link between you getting published and the government saying, well, if they've gone, if the media's gone this haywire, we need to rein them in?
Yeah, well, probably. I'm a powerful man, James, and they recognise that power.
Pete's been gagged by the Cambodian government,
yeah.
So
yeah,
too dangerous power. For Phnom Penh.
That's it.
Absolutely. So back to Australian news. So one of the things that came out of the budget last week was the idea of, well, not the idea, but the policy of a ban on cash payments of over $10,000. Now, obviously, well, the government says that they've brought this in to combat the black economy, or just, you know, underworld dealings, I guess. There's obviously a whole range of problems with it. I mean, the obvious one goes to people in abusive relationships. Gideon, what did you make of the policy?
Well, that's one element that Matthew Lesh has written so well about. I was away for the budget, so I checked the papers, you know, on my iPad from my hotel room overseas, and I couldn't believe that this item in particular came out of the budget too. The government is not just content to take away as much as 47% of our own money, they're actually now going to tell us how we engage in transactions with the money they do let us have, and by saying, well, you know, you can spend $999 in cash on an item, but if you spend $9,999 on an item, but if you spend $2 more than that, well, you're out, and it's illegal and it's going to be cracked down upon. There are so many elements to why this is a lousy idea. As you said, Matthew Lesh has written that forcing people to use credit cards for transactions can actually allow for financial abuse by domineering spouses and partners and so on. A victim of domestic violence or so on may want to purchase a car or some means to live a better life, and that will be harder when the abusive spouse will see their bank statements. Mm. But there's also plenty of reasons people might not want to use credit cards. There's implications now for big data, getting a record of what your consumption patterns are using an identifiable credit card. Now, that look, I have to admit, I mostly use my credit card for most transactions. You know, I like the convenience of it. I don't like carrying around cash. I like getting frequent flyer points and all sorts of other things, but it's good to have the option. And this is such a... And the other element to this is, though, James and Pete, I have no idea how they're going to actually enforce this, because the whole argument is there are too many contractors taking cash under the table and cleaners and so on. So what makes you think that they're going to fill out a form or suddenly be compliant because there's a rule against being paid under the table?
Yeah.
If they're flouting the law now, they'll flout and not reporting their income for tax purposes and so on. They're not exactly going to comply with a requirement to pay in credit card, not cash. But don't take my word for it. The government appears to have no idea how they'll implement it either. I looked at the report from the Black Economy Task Force from which this stupid idea has emerged. And on page 8, I've got it in front of me, it says, it talks about the cash ban, how wonderful it'll be, and then concludes by saying the government will consult on how best to implement the new cash payment limit and related reforms. So you can consult all you like, but they appear to have brought in this policy with absolutely no idea how it'll actually be implemented in practice.
Oh, which would be a first for this government, to be honest. last thing I want to say is something that you found today, and you posted up on the old Food and Lifestyle Slack channel here at the IPA. Macca's has come forward with a bold new burger, and you're sceptical. I want to get into the bottom of why.
Oh, well, we're getting...
Because in Macca's, I trust. That's my general policy.
Look, I do know the hamburger game.
I've always been a huge fan of the genre and that particular operator, but and thank you for raising the important issues. But, The Big Mac Ultra is like, I think, a Big Mac with extra sauce or something.
That seems to be the idea.
Yeah. I mean, I was underwhelmed by the chicken Big Mac. I thought it was, a bit hit. It was okay, but it was pretty overrated. I'm waiting for things like the McRib. Why can't we get the McRib in this country?
Now, you also posted a sandwich that I had not yet heard about.
Oh, the McGriddle.
The McGriddle. Now, explain to our listeners what that is, and then explain to me why I can't get one.
So a griddle is a sort of a cakey type, almost like a pikelet, and it has maple syrup injected into it. So when you bite into it, it releases maple syrup in your mouth. Now the McGriddle is, imagine a McMuffin with griddles instead of... I see Bolt, for those listening at home, drop Bolt eating an A4 sheet of paper right now.
Notes.
Sorry, got hungry there. That was the only thing I had near me.
So the McGriddle is like an egg McMuffin or a bacon and egg McMuffin with griddles instead of English muffins. So I've had one in the US. I had one 8 years ago when I went to New York. And it's every bit as good as it sounds. It's just maple syrup and bacon and egg and all those other beautiful things all together. Why we don't have it in Australia, I suspect Australian tastes have not evolved to that level just yet. It might not be a market leader here.
So,
But I guarantee you, if there was a market demand for that product in Australia, then the AMA and the Cancer Council and every other two-bit advocacy group in this country would be lining up to say, this will bring the end of public health in Australia as we know it. So
absolutely.
We can't have nice things in this country.
Yeah, sugar taxes would be brought in within 24 hours of that burger being launched. And I'd still pay the $75 to get it. So.
The hell with sugar taxes, they'd make you put it in plain packaging. You'd have to keep it behind the counter that's hidden. You'd have to show ID.
It'd be a photo of a very happy man walking out of a McDonald's restaurant. It's like, this could happen to you.
Yep. And absolutely, you could not pay cash for it.
Oh, no way. Yeah.
No way. It would have to be on some sort of transaction record and all sorts of other things.
Yeah, with a government seal. Anyway, Gideon, thank you so much for joining us. Yeah, we'll have you back on again.
That Cheers, guys. Fun. Great to be back.
Yeah.
Nice one.
Okay, thank you to Mark and Gideon for those interviews. Really awesome chat.
That was so good.
Yes.
With both of them, but particularly Mark.
Absolutely.
You know what I mean.
I think they were both equally awesome, Pete.
Gideon, you were fantastic. You know what I mean.
Gideon, I'm a better friend than Pete is. No, remember that.
Gideon, you know what I mean.
All right, let's get into this. So let's go through some stories from around the world that made us laugh this week. Q&A Clap, our favorite segment, probably our only segment. Except for the, it's coming back. Speaking Truth to Power, presented by Peter Gregory.
We've got some segments in the works, actually.
Once we do. We'll get to this one. Sorry. We had a similar one on the drum a few weeks ago. This one was a good one. So Van Badham, obviously the drum, one of ABC's chat shows, Van Badham was on. Got a quote here. The more diverse you are, the stronger you are, because if you create mechanisms like gender quotas, like they've got in the Labor Party, the most meritorious people advance through the system.
Thank you.
Going with the old, just saying the opposite of what it is and then saying that that's what it is.
I mean,
can you give me more context around who Van Badham is?
So Van Badham is a writer in Australia. She writes for a few different publications. She's a bit of a lefty, and there's a couple of clips we've got on our Facebook page of her and Simon getting into a bit of verbal sparring on different TV shows.
Really?
Yes. So what if people are new to the show, the Q&A clap is basically Pete and I get jealous when someone's vocus sort of, you know, knee-jerk left opinions get applauded by a Q&A audience and we feel a bit jealous. So we often want to know what it would feel like to get a Q&A clap from our own opinions. So Pete, do you have anything inspired by what Van Badham has said?
I did. Regulation, red tape, tax, and a very high minimum wage and award system promotes innovation, entrepreneurship, growth, and human flourishing.
Thank you.
I mean, it doesn't make any sense at all, but sure, Pete. It's not the same way that you've done it.
Okay,
that's good. I just want to point out that the University of California's microaggression list, so list of things that are going to be microaggressions, include the quote, "I believe the most qualified person should get the job." Yeah. So if Van Badham believes that qualified people should get the jobs, then she's just guilty of committing a microaggression against women and minorities.
That is exactly right.
Thank you.
You have identified a microaggression, James.
Yeah, I've attacked Van Badham from the left. They said it couldn't be done. I showed them wrong.
Very good.
Cool. So we'll move on to another story. So Gillian Triggs, obviously former Human Rights Commissioner here in Australia, great friend of the IPA, as you would imagine, has tweeted out this week that we must... So she's part of this new campaign to talk about digital rights and what is your online profile, which is obviously actually a pretty important topic. Make sure that people are respecting those sort of things. But I found it pretty funny, her tweet about it. "We must consider two fundamental human rights, fair access to the internet and the right to personal privacy and freedom of expression."
Did she actually use the word fundamental?
She did. So access to the internet, if you're playing along at home, that is a human right.
They were sat there, you know, on the fields of Runnymede. okay, one more thing, King.
The 4G around here is internet. Crap. What are you going to do about it?
Yeah.
Well, where is the NBN?
We thought she hated human rights, but obviously not.
Yeah. So, well, if you are playing along at home, freedom of speech, not a human right.
Yeah.
Access to the internet is a human right.
Okay.
So you can go on YouTube, but you can't leave a comment, and you can only upload videos of cats.
Yeah.
So that's where we are.
All right. Well, look, James, it's a start.
It's a start. Well, she didn't mention freedom of expression there.
Yeah.
Just feel that she needs to unpack what that means to her.
Yeah.
Or since the meeting
has. She has.
Oh, right. Yeah. Okay. It's just not the right one.
Over the journey.
Pete, shall we talk Jamie Oliver?
Yeah, well, you know, I used to like Jamie Oliver. He had so much energy and passion, but he's just the worst now.
Yeah, I'm very firmly a Gordon Ramsay person.
He has convinced Scottish First Minister Nicola Sturgeon to ban two-for-one pizza deals in Scotland.
I'm sure it was a tough sell to her.
Well, I don't know. It's not in place yet. She just plans to do it in the future. She says obesity is a serious public health issue which cannot be ignored. We will tackle junk food promotions and the marketing ability of healthy food, blah, 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 blah. Jamie Oliver. Nicola Sturgeon has shown she cares about the health of Scotland's kids. There were some interesting tweets from the Scottish public that was featured in the newspaper that we read in Scotland, on the internet from Scotland. One tweet, which I thought was an interesting take, don't do it, Nicola. What's even the point in independence if we canny, which is a Scottish word, have two-for-one pizzas? So that's...
I mean, he's gone right. Get her on the podcast.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I don't know that Twitter's gender, but it was a very interesting point.
Absolutely. My point on this, until further notice, the left is no longer allowed to call itself fun. They do call themselves fun.
Really?
But if you're banning two-for-one pizzas, and if you're, you know, obviously Spotify banning problematic quote-unquote music, they're no longer allowed to call themselves fun.
The fun
they are the town from Footloose, all right?
I'm not familiar with that town.
Okay, well, basically, it's a town that banned, you know, music and dancing. And, you know, but they probably weren't great on pizzas and pizza deals.
Yeah.
So they're now the old-timey, you know, these damn kids and their freedoms. They're not allowed to call themselves fun anymore.
The ship sailed on the left being fun decades ago.
Really?
Well, I mean...
Hot take from Pete.
Yeah. Mate, that's what... Yeah. Carry on, James. That's all I had. Well said. Really well said.
That's all I had. Move on to another story, unless you got any more Silas to fire at that one.
What's that? I didn't hear what you said. I genuinely didn't hear what you said.
Just waiting for your turn to speak. So we'll move on to another story.
Because you spoke too quickly.
We'll move on to another story. So Teen Vogue is a magazine in the US for a long time, probably concerned with teen issues. Oh, you know, I don't want to generalize what teen issues are, but obviously it was like a bit of a fashion mag, pop culture kind of stuff. They've recently started toying with the idea of politics, and this week, obviously we featured a few of these, but I found from Teen Vogue was very interesting. Teen Vogue had an article basically just explaining Karl Marx to kids, which is, you know, obviously what teens look for when they open up a copy of Teen Vogue.
Yeah.
A centuries dead philosopher.
It's not who I'd hit for my analysis of that kind of thing.
No. I also found there was another article which was like, you know, Teen Vogue, what is capitalism? So it's a strong theme emerging.
We don't mind Teen Vogue tackling this stuff.
No.
For younger audiences.
No, absolutely. So they
just tune into us.
But. Yeah, hopefully. So what they did tune into was a public school teacher from the US who was explaining that how he uses Karl Marx to...
Oh, great.
..in his classes. I like this one. I did a little role-playing with my class. I tell them, I'm the boss, you're my workers, and you want to try and take me down. I have the money, I own the factory, I control the police, I control the military, I control the government. What do you guys have? His students usually blink at him, he says, totally clueless. Should give you an intention of how engaged they are right now. He insists they actually have something huge that he as boss will never have. It's always just one student whose hand shoots up and goes, we outnumber you, Brunt says. Not for long. If the if the history of communism is to be studied, they won't have outnumbering for long.
Yep.
I love Teen Vogue going for the Marxist thing. So I've written a few articles that I want to pitch Teen Vogue and obviously the way
Take
that Teen Vogue and these papers tend to go. 20 fashion tips for starving through winter.
Ooh.
I've got that one. 15 times massacres were committed for Marxist vision and it was everything. Oh, yeah. And the internet is divided over whether this gulag prisoner is a political dissident or just a minority. So I don't know. I've written them all. I'm going to send them to Teen Vogue, see what they say about them.
That could be a good start for Teen Vogue. Well, they're trying. That's one thing.
Okay, cool. Let's get to the last item.
Now, this is a very special item for us. Friend of the podcast, friend of the Hay team, Morgan Begg is getting married tomorrow to his fiancée. So we're just saying congratulations.
Not anyone else.
Speaking of podcast bumps.
Yeah, that's a huge one.
I think he was engaged. No, he wasn't. He became engaged after he went on the podcast.
So this is you come on one. This podcast, good things happen to any potential... listeners out there or guests.
So congratulations, Morgan.
Yeah, and you should probably get a Q&A clap for his troubles.
Thank you.
All right, cool. That's it for this week's show. I hope you guys enjoyed it. Thank you to Mark Bauerlein and to Gideon Rosner for coming on the show.
That both was great.
A lot of fun.
Both really good.
Yeah, both equally good, Pete.
Yeah, Both equally great.
You're lying. Nose grew as he said it. Cool. So if you guys like the show, thank you guys so much for listening. Thank you guys so much for downloading. Remember, we are available on iTunes, SoundCloud, our website, and our Hey What Did I Miss email. So you can listen through any of those. Also, remember, if you can tell people around you who enjoy politics or who might enjoy the podcast, make sure they're downloading and subscribing as well.
Start a conversation.
Absolutely. So Nina, where can people go if they want to be members of the IPA?
Just visit the website, ipa.org.au, and there's a click button called Join Button. And then click on it. And then starting as low as $22, you can become a member for 12 years. 12 months, sorry.
You can buy 12 years. 12 times, what is it?
12 months.
Yeah, but how much does it cost?
$22.
So you get 12 times that, whatever, that's probably like a million or something. You can get 12 years.
258.
There's literally no way I would know.
Is it really?
No, it's 268.
I don't know. We're ideas, guys.
You talk to
the boys in corporate about what 12 years is. We're ideas, guys.
Talk to the bean counters.
Big picture. Big picture. That's what you come for me and Pete for.
Talk to the bean counters.
Nerds at accounting.
Get your abacus out, mate.
Oh, come on, Andy. All right, cool.
Sorry, we've got to finish now.
See you guys next week.
Bye.